Welcome to another episode of the Entangling Web3 podcast. It is 1st of January, 2025. Happy New Year, Alec. How are you?
Happy New Year. Well, we're actually recording this before the Christmas break, but I imagine right now everyone is nice and filled from Christmas. And today's a very special episode because we're going to be giving our predictions for 2025 and also reviewing the predictions for 2024. I'm excited to go through this. How are you, Jack?
Yeah, very, very well. I'd like to say I've enjoyed Christmas, but as you said, that's in the future right now. So, excited to be back in the studio. Again, shout out to Vorboss for being in this lovely studio that they provided for us. So, yeah, getting the ropes of doing physical recordings is very interesting still. It's our second IRL episode. But, yeah, why don't we get straight into the outlook for the year by starting with a review of our predictions from last year. So what we thought was going to happen in 2024.
That was a great way of bringing that back. Yeah, so we'll whiz through these because I think a lot of predictions actually went well. Like, I'm not saying that we were prophets. I think a lot of them were quite obvious. Like, let's go with the first one. So the first one that we said last year was we think there will be an end to the bear market, the crypto bear market. And there was a high likelihood that basically the spot Bitcoin ETFs would be approved. And that happened in early 2024, leading to a surge in institutional interest in Bitcoin and all things crypto. So we saw a brief crossing at 70K back in the early days of 2024. And now, well, we're just before Christmas and Bitcoin right now is at 108K or something like that. So yeah, well and truly out of the bear market and into the bull market.
Yeah, I mean, we had a couple of episodes about the ETFs, right? And that was kind of part of this broader narrative that, you know, as with the cycles in Bitcoin and crypto generally, we're expecting at some point for us to be in, you know, the next part of the cycle, which is to break the bear market. And obviously that happened. Again, there were no financial advice predictions this year, but we did think that the spot ETF approvals would have a bigger impact, and they clearly have, right? So the BTC ones that we covered early, you know, pretty much this time last year, actually, I think we were talking about them being imminent. Mm. And then obviously the Ethereum ones followed pretty shortly after that, a couple of months, maybe 4 or 5 months after that. So yeah, and that is very much borne out as a good prediction. So I'm glad we included that one.
Yeah, I don't want to spend too much time talking about this stuff. Like, I hate the, you know, kind of the many, many crypto podcasts out there that just talk about price and numbers and, you know, shill this coin. We're not that. But what it does mean is there is institutional interest and understanding of the benefits and, you know, core characteristics of Bitcoin, and maybe less so for some of the other cryptocurrencies. We haven't seen the same popularity that has gone into, say, the Bitcoin spot ETFs in Ethereum ETFs. So yeah, just something to be aware of, but we'll maybe talk about this a little bit later. So the second one was a big, you know, I know you're a massive fan of this. You love this stuff. You've probably talked about this. I think we actually did talk about this for an entire episode, was the Bitcoin halving. And actually, Jack, you got this right. The Bitcoin halving did happen.
I know. The only prediction that couldn't have gone wrong. I mean, in theory, you know, what if Bitcoin had all failed for some reason, right? There could have been a catastrophic event. But obviously, no, that didn't happen. The Bitcoin halving went ahead as expected and predicted in April 2024. And I guess in terms of the predictions, one of the things that most people were saying around this was, well, what's the impact going to be on the price?
Number go up.
Number go up. That's what people tend to think. But again, one thing we noted in looking at people's coverage of this was the fact that the impact on price tends to lag actually by around 9 months to a year of the halving. So, you know, you just mentioned the current Bitcoin price, how much has gone up recently. How much of that can we really attribute to the halving? I mean, I'm skeptical about that, right? I don't think that's necessarily having... we're not just seeing that 9 month lag of that, but you know, it's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy at this point, right? Yeah. So
number go up, no idea why, but we said it was going to go up, and we said that there was going to be a halving. So two for two, basically. So the third one, a bit more ambiguous. We were talking about the rise of CBDCs. So we did see some announcement in the past year. Brazil and India basically launched, well, they had pilots earlier than 2024, I think. And in 2024, they actually launched the first phases of their CBDCs in kind of localized jurisdictions. So we are seeing more and more countries developing. I think it's over 130 countries right now currently developing a central bank digital currency. But there's still conversations around, you know, what's the privacy implications, what's the centralization implications, like why do I need a CBDC when crypto is kind of gaining such traction and such popularity. So I'm not going to say that that was an accurate prediction. Like I actually thought they'd be further ahead. I thought that, say, European countries might be further ahead than they are right now. But as with a lot of things, the kind of the crypto savviness and the kind of the crypto interest and enthusiasm comes from countries like, say, countries situated in South America, where there's maybe less trust in governments. They want to leapfrog countries like the US. They're a bit less risk averse. They're willing to take risks. So that's why we're seeing these being kind of deployed in India and Brazil. And also there's a big win for remittances. So obviously, India has a lot of people abroad that send money back, same for the Philippines. So they are kind of the people that are really pushing the envelope when it comes to CBDCs.
Yeah. And I think this is, for me, it's less about, okay, the rise of CBDCs may be part of the prediction, but we predicted that there'd be potentially a rise of CBDCs, and I don't think we've seen that directly, but we've kind of seen the energy that would have been going in that space, going into the broader institutional adoption of, you know, crypto assets, digital assets, whatever we'll call them generally, I think, right? So CBDC is just one class of that. We talked, you know, recently with Crypto Robbie about the fact that it's kind of a subclass of a stablecoin anyway, a CBDC. So I think a lot of the moving parts that you need aligned to make CBDCs happen, that a lot of that kind of early building blocks has kind of progressed in 2024. But you're right, we haven't seen kind of full-scale rollouts of CBDC. So yeah, that's one that kind of still put a pin in for now, I think.
I'm glad you brought that up, the idea of like maybe the recent institutional adoption and regulatory clarity around this stuff has maybe kind of pulled back a lot of the, say, the progress of CBDCs, because the big institutions are quite happy now to play around with Bitcoin and things like this. And stablecoins is obviously having its moment right now. What was the stat I saw? Like Tether has higher revenue than BlackRock, but has like a company of like 100 people. Don't quote me on that, but it's something like that. They're basically making
it's like highest revenue per capita or something, or high profitability.
Yeah, highest revenue per capita, like, but also the tiny, tiny amount of people working there, like 100, 200 people, is a bit bonkers that they can do this. So yeah, stablecoins is having its moment. Obviously, Bitcoin's having its moment. So maybe that's kind of to the detriment of CBDCs and the CBDC agenda generally.
Yeah, and I think if you look at how people were talking about CBDCs a couple of years ago, they were saying, okay, we're not very pro-crypto. We're going to be on this kind of regulated form of digital money that we are very much in control of. And that's taken so long to come to fruition, and now everyone's kind of caught up with accepting digital assets as they are, right?
Like,
so
if you trust in the crypto itself, what's the benefit of CBDC? Well, it's effectively a crypto / stablecoin that is run, or kind of, I guess, minted and burned and managed by a central bank. So it's, yeah, as people kind of trust these things more and more, maybe the angle for CBDCs is lessened.
Yeah, I agree. I think the use case, the value proposition is less compelling in a world where you have, you know, a scaled Bitcoin, a highly usable stablecoin, things like that. So
100%.
Yeah, we'll kind of come back to that one in the year.
That one was actually a bad prediction. Yeah. CBDCs would rise. There'd be more things. So vague.
But actually, you know, just to close out on this point, I think that's something that we didn't see coming, was just how much more institutional interest there would be in crypto in general. Right? We were kind of thinking, oh, CBDCs will carry on kind of trundling forward. And then we didn't anticipate this kind of massive influx of
activity. 180 effectively with so many of these things. But yeah, it's a really good point.
It's totally different kind of feeling around the industry to this time last year, which is, you know, a very good thing in our eyes, I think. Another one of our predictions, I can't remember exactly now how much we were saying it was going to be successful, but we were saying kind of, let's keep an eye out for the metaverse and digital experiences, right? So I'm pretty sure at the time we were fairly down on the current kind of trajectory of the metaverse, right? Meta itself, Facebook, was pulling back some investment. They were kind of not focusing so much on the products around the metaverse, right, this time last year, and it was kind of seen as a bit of a laughing stock and a failure. And then we said, kind of, let's see what happens with the Apple Vision Pro. So obviously that did come out this year. You had the first kind of user feedback for it, and what do you think about that as a prediction?
Well, I think we kind of knew in advance, like everyone knew that Apple were working on this metaverse style device from like June 2023. So everyone knew they were working on it, and all the predictions were it was going to be launched in 2024, and it was launched on the 2nd of February 2024. I think we didn't know how successful it would be. I think a lot of people know that when Apple moves into a space, it's almost certainly going to be a success. So I think because of that, and purely because of that, we both thought that there was going to be a big change in how people perceive, you know, the metaverse experience and metaverse technology going forward. And that has happened. I think the thing that we didn't see was that, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, we did a whole episode of the Meta Orion.
That's true.
And like everyone saw you know, Meta pushing very hard on the metaverse. Obviously, the name change, Mark Zuckerberg flying through space and doing these like, these conference style things in the metaverse. But we didn't see how successful, say, the Meta Orion was going to be. And that hasn't been launched. That's just been announced right now. But you also have the Meta VR glasses.
Yeah. Yeah. They have kind of two, you've got two competing Meta products, but like the reception of them has been widely positive, right? I think
so. I think that, well, it's fine. What they call Meta VR glasses, what are they called?
They're the Ray-Ban ones, right?
Yeah, sorry. So they have the Ray-Ban Meta glasses, which are those smart glasses that just record, super simple, but they have flown off the shelves. They are so popular. And I think this has kind of given Meta the litmus test to say, yeah, we're going to push hard into the Orion. They've released 30 of these real kind of metaverse style smart AR glasses that they're now testing out with KOLs and whatnot. And I think the goal is to now work out how to productionize that and to mass produce it for like 2026 or something like this. But yeah, I don't think that was something that people would have predicted, is that Meta was then going to do a 180, then do another 180 to say we're going back to the metaverse.
Yeah, maybe it was an intentional fake all along, right?
Yeah,
it was
the
180 just to kind of turn back on us.
Call an ambulance, but not for me.
Yeah, I don't get that reference, but
what?
it was you're right, it was, we saw not only the release of Apple Vision Pro, and I think that got a fairly good reception. Like, you started seeing people using it, you're seeing some credible use cases for it. Obviously, this is like the alpha version of the product, essentially, right? It's the first time that people are going to be using it from Apple, but they're clearly serious about it. But yeah, we didn't see Facebook and Meta almost doubling down on, you know, this time last year, I would never have predicted that we'd be seeing and talking positively about Facebook products again in the metaverse realm. So yeah, that's a big one.
100%. Again, so again, small, minor, vague prediction, the metaverse of digitals was going to go up, and it did. So number five was, we said that the area of AI and blockchain was going to become much more heavily overlapped, and there'd be many more like solutions out there for blockchain solving AI problems and AI solving blockchain problems and all this kind of stuff. I actually don't think I've seen this. Like, I've heard of projects that are working on this, but I've not seen anything to the scale that I think this is actually solving problems in a kind of generalized and effective way. We've had a lot of episodes on some of the problems that AI is causing. It's causing like absolute mayhem in a lot of the kind of social media space with misinformation, fake content, bots, all this kind of stuff. And I think the time is ripe now for someone to come up with a kind of universal blockchain solution to solve a lot of this fake content, misinformation, fake bot style, because the problem's there and we're just waiting for a solution. But we haven't seen it yet, I don't think.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I think we saw this take off in a conceptual way this year. You know, everyone was talking about much more meaningfully than in the previous year about the integration of AI and blockchain. I think most people accept now that there is something to be struck there, and it's not just buzzword plus buzzword. There are core reasons they can be used together. But you're right, in practical terms, I personally just don't think that the appetite is there to build the AI plus blockchain pieces while there's the AI space race going on, right? There's so much money being put into, let's get the best AI first and let's make the money off it, that they're like, well, the blockchain stuff can come later. And also, that kind of feeds into how we think, I think, about the AI and blockchain crossover, is the blockchain is almost kind of the guardrails for AI. And people, you know, when you're building the fastest, the biggest, the best, you're not necessarily thinking about guardrails, right? Something we've highlighted a lot of the time about these AI models. You're not thinking about, you know, how do we make it as safe as possible? You're thinking, how do we move fast and break things, right? So I think the whole, how do we, you know, put the guardrails back on it with blockchain, that's taken a bit of a backseat.
And maybe that's also like part of the solution as well, is it's quite hard to have this generalized blockchain solution when there's so many different AI models running around. But if you do have, say, a winner, the one model to rule them all, that kind of is the golden standard that everyone uses, you maybe don't even need blockchain for that. Then you could just have like a centralized solution that basically just monitors and regulates what is real, what's not real, and everyone just accesses that central repo to verify if content is real or not. Let's see. I think that there will be a lot of developments, and I think we'll talk a little bit about this later as well.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, how do you even build a blockchain solution for something that's just where the goalposts are moving every 2 minutes, right? It's impossible. Speaking of goalposts moving, we also talked a little bit about regulatory clarity. So that we were saying, you know, as you'd expect most years in any industry to get more clarity, to kind of tend towards that point where you know actually the rules of the game you're playing. I don't think we saw a huge progress in this year. Like, we already had Mika by this time last year in Europe. There hasn't been, I don't think, any groundbreaking new legislation of note in certainly kind of the West, in the UK, Europe, and in the US, and still kind of more questions. You've had regime changes and governments in most of these places this year as well, you know, in America, in the UK, and Europe. But that is all to say, everything we talked about with the institutional adoption, I think, primes us to maybe repeat the prediction for the next year. I think now people are really demanding it. So I think maybe we can just repeat this one.
I don't want to talk about regulation too much. It's so boring, but it is quite important. The crypto regulation, I think it was kind of just a slight continuation of what we already saw. Nothing too crazy. No one banning, no one reopening, that kind of stuff. On the AI, maybe a bit more developments because it's happening so quick. We are seeing more conversations happen. I know that there's more solid regulatory standards, AI EU Act and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
On quantum and metaverse, maybe less so. But yeah, let's basically overall, I think we made two or three good predictions and two or three very vague predictions.
Pretty good hit rate.
That's not bad for the first one.
I'll take it.
So should we go to our predictions for 2025? I think the first one, like you kind of inferred earlier, is rise of institutional adoption. Bing, bing, bing. Who thought about that one? But I don't want to just talk about this from a financial perspective. I want to talk about what the impact is. I think it's obvious to everyone right now. There is institutional interest in Bitcoin, and it's growing quite rapidly. But what I want to talk about is really like what this means. Is I think traditionally, if we look over the last, you know, since 2008, the type of investors that have been in Bitcoin and crypto generally has been retail investors. That is individuals like Jack or I, or potentially people listening at home. As this changes to the big institutions, it's no longer just an individual who's, you know, reading someone's post and saying, oh, I should invest in this, or doing like the absolute most shallow amount of research for going into it. It is a company with a research team of 100 people who are deep diving into the fundamentals of that crypto, of that asset, to say, what is the core problem this is solving? Or what are the core characteristics? What are the fundamentals of this? So I think the outlook is going to change significantly, where it's no longer about a quick buck, and it's more about what's the long-term upside of this.
Yeah, that is an optimistic way of looking at it, and I'd like to agree. Because when you say quick buck there, I think I agree in terms of the individual. I think, you know, it will probably keep moving towards an investment asset, a kind of investment product, right? The people treating it the way they treat, you know, getting into stocks and shares, ISA in the UK, for example, and it'll be part of diversifying a portfolio, right? It's like a, what do they call it? Alternative assets.
Okay.
It's like an alternative asset to invest in. And I think that's, people will continue to move that way. It'll be offered in more places. I think the quick buck will be still being made from the institutions who are adopting first, because I think that's partly what the ETFs were about, right? It was about these large players offering a new product, right? That's all it is at the end of the day, offering a new ETF product, because they knew there was demand from their customers, right? And there is a quick buck to be made there, quite possibly, for all the institutions by bringing these products out, right? And especially for things like Bitcoin, because it has the reputation it has.
Yeah.
I think it's bizarre where we are at the end of 2024. Mm. Like literally just today, I think BlackRock are releasing kind of explainer videos on like,
bonkers.
What is Bitcoin, right?
Bonkers.
But to say, you know, at the end of last year or the year before that, that they'd
still
be doing
in the bear market, not in sure like what regulation was looking like, not even sure if people would be investing or could invest. You're right. And I think, if you ask anyone, an institution or an individual, do you want to make a quick buck? Everyone will always say, yeah. I think my perspective here is it will be a longer term outlook. And I think it's more that they will do the research before they list a product, for example. I think there'll be less Ponzi schemes and that kind of stuff, because a larger share of the market will be led by the big institutions who will only list that product once, or that asset class, or that asset, once they've done the research and know that there's not going to be a rug pull. This is a long-term investment. This does have like a 30-year upside rather than just a two-month potential. Like we're seeing right now is meme coins. Meme coins are the thing.
Yeah.
And I kind of get it in a way. Like a lot of people get upset with, say, the kind of the big, I don't know, 20 cryptos or whatever, because they have VCs invested. And if there is potential upside and someone invests, the VCs get priority. So there's less avenue for profitability. But institutions, I do not think, will touch meme coins. They're just going to be looking at what is the narrative? What are the core principles? What are the characteristics? Can we invest in this for 20 years and actually get an upside from it? And are the people that we allow to invest in it safe?
Yeah, I think if you I would personally now place us, if you think of the Gartner kind of emerging tech cycle, the famous kind of graph, I think we're now over that. We're over the hump, the initial hump, right? We've gone past the trough disillusionment, which is probably where we were this time last year. I think we were properly in the trough right then, I think. And now we are kind of climbing up slowly that slope of enlightenment towards, as you said, the more responsible, kind of mature treatment of Bitcoin and other crypto assets as an investment vehicle. So yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense. And I'm glad you mentioned meme coins, because in a review of the year, we should actually really highlight those. That was one of the breakout themes of the year in crypto. And you know, what do you think of them in general? Because I am, for me, the jury's still out. I think I don't know if they are more harmful than helpful. A lot of people talk about them as this will onboard the next billion people into crypto. And yeah, it onboards people, but normally by losing their money, right?
Yeah, so, yeah. Who are the people saying that? Are they the people that are shilling the meme coins for it? Like, this will onboard the future generation, invest in my meme coin now. I am not strongly opposed to them, but slightly opposed to them. I think it does appeal to a lot of people that are in crypto to make that quick buck, or just to make a profit at the end of the day, right? When you can, say, spin something out overnight and then it goes up by 3 million instantly. You kind of, the idea of making quick, easy money is appealing to everyone, right? Which I think is fair. I think that's human nature, whatever, I don't care. The people that are shilling it and rug pulling it, that's the real issue there. And I kind of get the sell on it. It kind of makes sense when we look at some of the big cryptos. And like I say, typically what happens is, my understanding is, they have VC investment. And if, say, they get the first 1 million coins or something like that, and if there is a sell-off, say it goes 10x overnight, they get the priority to pull their coins out before any of the retail investors do. So if I'm someone who's come into that system, I'm like, well, this is completely unfair to me. Like, I can't make an easy profit from this. Why would I invest in this? Get it. So meme coins are like a way to say, there's these coins that are instantly being spun up everywhere. You can invest first, rug pull immediately, get out really quick. The thing is, I only see the real downside, the kind of the polarizing celebrity endorsement style people, like the Hoktuga, what's his name? The Hoktuga. No,
please do your best impression of that.
The Hoktuga.
Oh, God.
She is getting into a lot of crap right now because she launched a coin. Lots of people invested lots of money. I saw some story about a guy who took his grandma's savings and put it into the coin.
I really fail to see, because at the end of the day, it's bordering on the, or it's kind of piggybacking this whole idea of Web3 for community that we've talked about. And there's a completely valid use case of Web3 in a community, but it's essentially just monetizing someone's following for very little value in return, right? These meme coins aren't typically conferring anything else useful. And, you know, typically these fans are getting hurt. So yeah, I think it's one of those things that, like, while it is driving people to know more about crypto and to get involved in some way, it's, for me, it's quite a dangerous trend, and I'm interested to see if there's more crackdown on that next year. But no, we'll see.
Today's episode is sponsored by the VeChain Foundation.
Now, we often talk about how emerging technologies like blockchain have the potential to revolutionize sustainability, and VeChain is at the forefront of this green movement with initiatives like VBetterDAO. Let's take a closer look.
Imagine tracking small actions, like recycling, at low cost, making them valuable assets. These verified records build a massive collective impact, benefiting people through their own actions. Sound a bit complex, but VeChain made it fun. Explore our apps at vbetter.com.
VeChain's goal is to power a new era of sustainable solutions. So if you've got an app idea or just want to earn rewards for small, sustainable actions every day, go check out vbetterdao.com to find out more. And now, back to the show.
So, second predictions for next year, I think we'd have to mention, you know, shock, AI.
What's AI?
AI up, pet.
What? That's bad. You're cutting that out, aren't you? Of course, we have to mention AI. Like, it's all anyone's talking about still. But what's our prediction on it? What's your prediction on it?
I mean, my prediction is incredibly boring.
AI is going to be big.
AI is going to be bigger and bigger and bigger. Will we hit the singularity next year? Don't think so. But will we hear people talking more? But again,
I'll tell you what won't happen. I won't tell you what will happen.
There's a prediction for you that we won't have quantum AI supremacy next year. That's my prediction. But the main thing I would say in the AI prediction space is we will start seeing properly useful AI agents. I think that theme has become massive in the last 6 months. We've talked about it more and more frequently on the podcast. You know, we've spoken to Colin about them explicitly. Yeah. He's working in the area, but it seems to me like it's coming up more and more often, and I'm seeing more and more use cases for AI agents and ways they can actually help us. And I think, you know, we have got some good ones already, but they're still pretty early. You still have to be quite techie to use them. We're going to see some proper, like, commercially or consumer ready AI agents next
year. Yeah, I think the big difference there between what we see now is very much it's in an IDE, it's in an interface. So it's like, I can download this app and I can put things in and it will give me things back in the app. And when I think of an agent, I think that the agency and its kind of scope of influence is much bigger. So, like, I am constantly Googling for the point where there is like a marketing, PR, social comms AI agent that I can just say, here's our podcast. Please do all the social posts, do all the spiels and all that.
Then I'm out of a job.
And then, well, that's me. I'm out of the job, which is great. I want to sit on a beach in the Bahamas or something while you do all the work. But that's not there yet. But I think we're not too far from that. Yeah. It's like, it's got all the language capabilities. It just needs to have the rails, basically, to connect to all these different apps, say the social medias, the ability to pay, the ability to regulate, all this kind of stuff. And you are right. I think 2025 is going to be the year that we see these AIs move from just a small product interface on your screen to a more open world concept where they can just do the activities outside of the current boundaries that they have.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there, right? It's not a case of enabling technology anymore. It's just a case of productizing it. It's a case of putting the pieces together, because I think all the pieces are there. All the payment rail stuff is there if we need it. Mm-hmm. The AI is clearly there. It's clearly good enough. It's more about how do you connect them all together? How do you productize it? How do you iron out all the bugs, right? And so what's a typical product development life cycle? Maybe 6 months, 9 months to a year, depending on the product. So, you know, that's what we're seeing now. This stuff's been in the works already for 6 months. So we could see it as early as Q1, Q2, 2025 to see the proper version of these come out. So yeah, that would be probably one of my strongest predictions for next year, is that we'll probably end up using one, you know, at some point. Yeah,
I like that. I can't wait for it as well. We'll get ChatGPT back on the podcast, but in a more regular way. I think that we're going to see, we're going to see mass adoption in the less conservative industries. We're already seeing that. I think, like, say, the finances of the world, the techs of the world, like, they are using this almost in all processes right now. Yeah. I think we're going to start to see the companies that don't use it being marginalized and slowly pushed out. I think what we'll start to see towards the end of 2025 is the more conservative, risk-averse industries like healthcare, government, them starting to realize the value and them slowly starting to pilot schemes. Like, I think we'll start to see the NHS maybe pilot some initial kind of AI screening things end of 2025. I think we have to. Like, this government right now is trying to be ambitious. They have a lot of problems and not that much funding to kind of solve those problems. Yeah. I think we're going to have to see a pilot the end of this year for us to have any chance of the NHS being functional, basically.
Yeah, I mean, based on the speed that things typically move kind of in health systems, even in the UK where we have a kind of unified one, I think I would love that to be true. And I agree, we could really do with AI-assisted kind of healthcare and prognosis type things happening. I would doubt that it would happen within a year, to be quite frank.
A pilot end of the year?
Maybe launched, or maybe in the development, but I think a year's short. But, you know, again, maybe I'm just being pessimistic. But I'm really interested, just beyond seeing kind of the productization, et cetera, of AI, I'm really interested to see how nation states start to react to it properly, because we've had a year and a half now of LLMs being, you know, popularized and getting better and better and better. And, you know, we've always talked about the risk of replacement of jobs. For all this time, we talked about how it's happening in the arts. It's rife. We're having companies quite openly saying we're going to lay off people from our workforce and replace them with AI. And then 2025 will probably be the year where we actually see what a world looks like where that's happened on a large scale. So people displaced from jobs, processes being made more efficient. But how do, you know, again, there for different countries, it's going to be very different, right? In the UK, for example, we have all these issues with the health service, with kind of various backlogs in many different systems. You know, judicial system is famously takes a long, long time to work. Are we going to see any major progress in that in the next year?
I mean, it's a good point. I think, like I said, the UK's problem is productivity, right? Productivity is dipping, all this kind of stuff. We're a very desk-based, heavily reliant on finance and tech and that kind of stuff. So I think that's going to be a huge impact. AI is going to be the most impactful there, I think. Mm-hmm. The question is, like, do we get more from productivity than we lose from the potential kind of mass fallout from people losing their jobs? Yeah. I think countries like, say, in, I don't want to generalize, but Southeast Asia and India, where it's much more, there's a lot more, a larger percentage of the GDP and jobs is more, say, manual, I think they're going to be fine. Like, I think they'll be more resilient to this kind of change. Governments, like you say, especially in the West, like, I think are far too lethargic when it comes to this stuff. There won't be kind of systems in place to handle the mass job displacement we are going to see in the West. But this kind of comes in cycles, right? They talked about it when it came to the internet, when it came to the calculator. Sure. Yeah. This happens. I do think AI is going to do it at a much more extreme rate, but this is just human evolution always.
I agree. I think you've helped articulate now in my head what I was trying to say, actually, on the social impact, is that we're probably going to see, you know, as you say, in Britain, we have really low GDP growth. Now, AI might well help GDP growth tick up, but I think the source of it will be more corporate based than from individuals, right? Because people are getting laid off, less money going in their pockets, right? Yeah. Productivity on the individual level reduces, but the corporate level, the capitalistic corporate level, increases, right? Because they're able to do more with less capital. So we could address our productivity problem as a nation, but that's going to be kind of separating it from the individual, which is, again, it could be a problematic.
There's pros and cons, right? And depends, like, if you see, if we companies have robust training schemes in place, a company of 100 people will then be able to work like 10,000 people.
Yeah.
But realistically, what's going to happen is that company of 100 people is going to have one or two people that can now do the job of 100 and they'll lay off 98. Bad probably for private sector stuff. Depends what your mindset is. I think it's personally bad. But when you look at the public sector standpoint, ideal, right? Because there's a limited amount of money. There's almost unlimited amount of problems and productivity requirements. So I think we'll never grow to hit whatever ceiling we need. So I think it public sector, good. Some of the other things I want to talk about when it comes to AI, we're already seeing it, is the ease with which you can spin up a bot that can, say, do misinformation online or deepfake someone. I think this is a really big thing. Like banking right now, it's all, my banking is based on voice call, video, face proof. And like the deepfakes online now, indistinguishable, like completely indistinguishable. I think this is going to become a really big problem on social media, potentially, where people are kind of pretending to be someone, making announcements that aren't real and all this kind of stuff. I think it's just going to become more and more prolific, and to the point where governments are going to have to take a stand on this. I don't know what that looks like.
Yeah.
But something, there's going to be some like key event, you know, like whether they bring it to court
that's
or whatever.
That's a prediction. There's going to be a key event.
Something's going to happen this year.
Yeah. I think, okay, I agree. And we've been, again, it's not something unique to 25, because 2024, we obviously saw so much of this already. You can spin up a picture of whatever you want of any person in any situation. And I actually think it's interesting that we have seen this year the different approaches of AI companies to this problem, right? Because if you look at something like OpenAI, ChatGPT's approach is to essentially ban you from doing certain things, right? So for Kia Finlow Bates episode, I remember trying to get a DALL-E image of blockchain. I said, based on kind of blockchain Gandalf, right? Because that's his name. I said, so like, I want a wizard in it. It looked like Gandalf. And it said, no, can't do that. Can't use the likeness of Gandalf.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So they're protecting people's corporate IP, that kind of thing, and very much limiting what you can do. Whereas obviously lots of other places like Grok, it's a wild
free for all.
You can do whatever you want.
But then you were just like, okay, go to Google, describe Gandalf, and then you put the description of Gandalf into chat. There's so many workarounds for this. Like one of the things I saw back in the day was like, I think someone was like, build me a gun or something like that. And it was like, no, I'm not going to do that. That's against that policy. It was like, okay, show me how not to build a gun or something like that. Like, here you go. Yeah. Here's how not to build a gun.
Yeah. Okay. So we've said AI is going to be big. That's fine. That makes sense. What a great prediction. Well, and again, I think we're it's okay to not make specific predictions in this space, because most people doing it is just price predictions. They're like, this number's going to go up over here and this one's going to go down. And I think we are, as I said, I'm very serious about that Gartner picture. This kind of
picture. It's on his wall.
This slope of enlightenment is, you know, where we will slowly find the true value of this whole space right now. And that's what it is. It's finding out. A lot of the ideas are already out there.
Yeah.
We're just kind of slowly seeing it. So
one thing I want to jump on this as well that I actually forgot to mention. Right now, a lot of these AI companies are burning money. It's kind of a race to the bottom in a way where they're buying all the they're buying all the hardware. Almost none of them are profitable, on the assumption that basically, if they outlast everyone else and they become the final player, then they'll be able to up the prices and make a lot of money. But there's so many AI companies right now that aren't profitable. We're going to have to see either like the companies reduce, like fewer companies, one or two that are left that actually can then make all the money from all the people, or more specific models that aren't just generalized. You can ask whatever query you want. They're very specific and they target a very specific sector. And I think right now, like you say, everyone's just building as much and as quickly as possible, trying to expand to fill the space. I think that's going to change and there'll be fewer entities, more concentrated on specific use cases, because these things are incredibly energy intensive to run. So one of the stats is like training ChatGPT-3 used the energy equivalent to powering 1,000 homes for a year.
Wow.
No okay. idea if that's big or not.
And what kind of home?
You know, ChatGPT told me that as well.
Jeff Bezos?
Yeah, that's so true. The point is...
Well, ChatGPT gave me that.
ChatGPT did. It's actually like 100,000 homes or something. Yeah, yeah. But the point is, what I'm trying to say is use a lot of energy. It's very energy intensive, very expensive. And yeah. right now, it's not clear that they're getting the ROI on that financially.
Yes, agreed. And we've spoken a lot before about the need to monetize AI, right? And the fact that that isn't necessarily there yet. We spoke about, you know, using crypto to do it mm-hmm. on like a pay per basis. But yeah... I agree. As alongside the products themselves being kind of maturing in the next year, we're going to start to see the business models hopefully mature. But again, there's so much venture backing here. And because it's that space race, right? The space race wasn't profitable going to the moon, right? And people think the pot of the kind of the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow for AI is so big, right? Getting the singularity, getting AI supremacy. That's what they're racing for. Yeah. And they don't know what the kind of profit will be when they get there.
Yeah, I think, and to relate it back to your point about AI agents, I think one of the problems is because they're so containerized right now, you go to an app, you do the things, but you're the one that has to action it. I'm not going to pay much money for that. If you can replace, say, someone completely to do your entire marketing operation, that's like a 40K job. Like, you're going to pay a lot of money for that. And I think as the borders of these AI agents expand, then they'll be able to make a lot more money from them.
Yeah. So let's move on to our third prediction. And, you know, speaking of AI and the problems of misinformation online, one of the things that goes hand in hand with that is identity, right? So knowing that you are a real person compared to a chatbot, for example, that's a reason for digital identity. And again, something we've talked about a lot on the podcast. And I think we can safely say that things are moving quite rapidly now in the digital identity space, and most of that is anchored by blockchain. And I actually saw a really interesting, you know, highlighting this whole problem in the kind of in the A16Z crypto kind of looking forward to next year. So not to steal one of their points, but they're basically saying the idea of proof of personhood is something that is using AI in the future is going to be contingent on, right? Being able to prove in some reliable way. And obviously we've had this WorldCoin coming out in the last year as well with the eyeball scanners and stuff,
which is so weird,
so creepy. But, you know, whether or not that's the right way of doing it, I think the problem is real, and being able to have a reliable proof of personhood, especially when we have these AI agents going around pretending to be people, is a great reason to go further down this digital ID rabbit hole.
Yeah, like even on content authentication, like you say, authenticate an individual, that's obviously probably the most important thing, but authenticating, say, digital art or authenticating whatever media is out there is also important. It's a big problem. Like, more and more of our interactions are digital, online. Do you know who you're really interacting with? And the answer is no a lot of the time. Like, it's becoming so close to reality right now that it's indistinguishable in a lot of ways. And AI is very good at simulating the auditory, simulating the visual, but it's not very good at breaking cryptographic proofs, right?
Yes.
Like, and public key infrastructure is going to be key to basically proving who I am. And for that, you need one, probably a certificate of authority. Is it a WorldCoin? Is it whatever digital identity provider you want to say, this is this person, this address is this person. But then you also want an open registry, probably. And probably the best way to do that is a blockchain or blockchain-based system to make sure it's tamper-proof, time-stamped, transparent, all these kind of wonderful characteristics we typically associate with blockchain. But yeah, I think the problem is we've been talking about digital identity for so long now. I feel like people have been having this conversation about 15 years.
Yeah.
It kind of does, in my mind, in a lot of ways, take a government to push it. And we are seeing governments push it. We see India, they've released the digital identity scheme to cover the 1.3 billion people. No idea how many people are actually using it. We've got George coming on soon from Kinexys. He's going to talk about the Web3 identity system that he's working on. Lots of projects happening. when are they going to gain mass adoption is my question.
Yes. And I agree completely with you on the need for government support for this, right? Mm-hmm. And finding the balance between a government issued identity, which is what you need to make a lot of the day-to-day uses of identity valuable, right? Most of the times that we're asked to verify identity in an important sense, right, when it's actually critical, mm-hmm. that's your government issued identity that you're talking about, yeah. right? Anyway, so you really do need government buy-in to make these meaningful, but then it's the openness of the systems that make them even more valuable than our current identity systems, mm-hmm. right? So if you just take normal identity and then say digital identity
yeah.
based on blockchain, that's great. It's a bit more efficient, a bit more portable. But the real superpower of it comes in opening systems up, right? Being able to have attestations from anywhere yeah. from your gaming, right? So getting people doing the right approach. And speaking of people with the right approach, this is why I think it's so good that we put this as a prediction, because it's one we can almost kind of tick off in a couple of weeks' time when we have some of the guys on from the Argentina Quark ID scheme, right? Mm-hmm. So we've got a real world example coming up on the show where we can talk about how digital identity is actually being used, is being rolled out in Buenos Aires. So yeah, that'll be a really interesting one to look out for.
Yeah, you're right. I'm glad you touched on the point of like a more self-sovereign identity standard where it shouldn't just be a government that says you are you. Your identity is built on so much more than just the government saying you are you. That's a big piece of it,
yep.
but it's, you know, your reviews on Amazon, it's what your friends say about you, it's your financial history. And I think not that everyone would want to put this stuff on chain, but more and more we are going to see things on chain, more people using crypto as it's adopted, more people interacting through Web3 schemas, like all this kind of stuff. And I want to know more than just this person has a passport when I'm interacting with them online potentially. I want to know they have an entire history that proves their personhood. So yeah, I think it's quite exciting. I think this, like I've seen loads of predictions that if the UK had a digital identity scheme that was generally adopted, it would increase GDP by 5 to 15%. Just through things like, I don't need to sign up every single time yeah, to exactly. you know, HMRC or sign up to Facebook. It's all based on one scheme on my phone. Mm. You know who I am. Like, you know, trillions or hundreds of billions, if not trillions, is lost every year with identity fraud. And I think things like, you know, strong cryptographic proofs that are linked to my device is really hard to break. And I think that is one of the most powerful use cases we're going to see, hopefully come, not, it's kind of, it's there already, but mm-hmm. hopefully being widely adopted this year.
Yeah. And speaking of broad adoption and wide adoption of digital identity, I don't want to say that 2024 was the year of it, right? We're saying it's a prediction for 2025. Which I think is valid. But we did see the nexus of maybe the biggest voluntary digital identity scheme we'll ever see, right? Mm-hmm. And it's in progress with Blue Sky. So we covered Blue Sky a few weeks ago. That has a huge digital identity scheme built into it. It's at the protocol level. It's how it works, right? Now, I've just had a little look on the usage numbers. That's up to around 25 million users already. It's rocketing up from where, you know, how fast that's grown from it just being opened up, what, a couple of months ago now. Mm-hmm. So I think partly the popularity of Blue Sky will be something we can measure the adoption of digital identity by, right? We can see if that gets to 100 million or half a billion users, then all of a sudden we have half a billion users of one of these open self-sovereign identity schemes that you can add these interesting things to. And then maybe governments think, well, maybe I'm not going to issue something completely different, or maybe I'm going to have to make sure it's compatible with that. So it's being led by Blue Sky and Jack Dorsey. Well, Jack Dorsey's old baby. We can't say Jack Dorsey's project, true. But yeah.
And I think, like, just to link it back to our second prediction, I think the rise in AI and deepfakes and misinformation is going to kind of push digital identity to the forefront. And, you know, you want to know who you're interacting with. You want to know it's not a fraudulent, you know, bot, basically.
Yeah.
But another point is around the training of AI. And, you know, when we talk about self-sovereign identity, a core tenet of that is data minimization, sharing the minimal amount of data needed for a proof, sharing the minimal thing online. And I think this is, you know, something Heather Leigh Flannery, a guest and friend of the podcast, talks about often, is when I train the AI, really what matters is the richness of the AI. Yeah. So I want it authenticated, which is not so fairly easy to do, but again, a core kind of principle of self-sovereign identity. And I only want the data that's relevant to the thing I'm training. I don't need your entire life history when I'm trying to train, you know, a medical robot or a medical AI or something like this. So I think AI is going to push the digital identity need to the forefront of the conversation next year. And the final thing I want to touch on, which I think has been talked about a lot, especially in the last couple of weeks, is the quantum agenda. So we did a couple of episodes on quantum computing and the impact of quantum computing. So you know, one of the breakthroughs we saw recently was the Google announcement of its state-of-the-art quantum chip Willow, which was boasting like a new record for the number of qubits, whatever that means. And, you know, immediately when we talk about quantum computing, one of the impacts is people think that it's going to be able to break a lot of security standards. So when I just talked about public key infrastructure being the gold standards and cryptographic proofs being the gold standards that can't be broken by AI, well, a lot of people are worried that they can be broken by some kind of, you know, general quantum computer. You know, this announcement by Google and Willow actually dropped the Bitcoin price immediately after, because people were like, this is going to undermine the entire, you know, backbone of Bitcoin, which is public key infrastructure or public private key infrastructure. My prediction here is we're so far away from it still. I think that you know, this announcement by Google was nice. It's a big improvement, all this kind of stuff. We could do lots of supercomputer things, but nowhere near breaking public key infrastructure that basically runs the entire world.
Yeah, it's funny to think about, you know, Google coming out and making a big announcement about, oh, we've got the best qubits now. We've got some of the best qubits.
We've got the best qubits.
Saying we've got the most powerful computer and everything. And then it's kind of funny to me why the price of something like Bitcoin would react to that, because what's the risk? Well, the risk is that they can steal my Bitcoin, right? They can crack my private keys. But everyone knows who would have stolen it, right? So why would Google go doing that? That's something I think is kind of a strange logic.
There's no proof, right? Like, you can't. That's the thing. Bitcoin's kind of anonymous. Let's try and cash it out. Well,
but that's kind of a mathematical proof, though, in a way. Like, if someone steals the keys,
the
only one who's capable, right?
Yeah, I get what you mean.
So anyway, it's just a funny thought that came to mind. But I think so. What the prediction here is that maybe the hype we've seen around, I mean, I'm glad we did our episodes when we did, like a couple of months ago, to precede this hype that we've seen around Google. But maybe the prediction is that the fear or the thinking around it right now is, you know, the hype that's been generated very recently is probably overblowing it and probably Definitely. Doesn't mean anything for the next year, right?
One of the things that I saw was that it's a 101 qubit announcement. Someone said it's going to take millions of qubits basically to be able to break SHA-256, which is the public key infrastructure that underpins a lot of this stuff. I think we're a far cry from that. One of the things I think we are seeing, though, is because there are advancements happening here and Moore's Law and all this kind of stuff, hopefully, where you imagine it would happen at an accelerated pace, as more people are kind of investigating and researching into this, we are going to see more and more cryptographies, more and more security schemes that are quantum resistant. That's a word that I'm seeing constantly. Yes. Or even like protocols and standards, like having one-time use addresses where you don't keep all your funds locked up in one account forever. But like we said before, there's a big risk with Bitcoin that there is these 1.1 million Bitcoins that are locked to the Satoshi address that everyone knows about. I think one of the biggest things is the migration of those dormant addresses or kind of fixed addresses to these new schemes, to these new standards, and potentially identifying people through that.
Yeah, I agree. There's lots of mitigation that needs to happen over some period of time, just in case the quantum, you know, computers do get to the level we're talking about. Actually, one of the things we should mention that happened in 2024 was the NIST, which is the kind of standards body for kind of cryptography schemes that get used widely in America. They actually completed the competition, or the competition has been complete for a while now, and they published the final schemes. They published the final schemes for post quantum crypto schemes, basically, right? So now they're in public, they're not, that people know about them. So I think maybe 2025 is one of the first years we see some of the major blockchains actually transition to those schemes, right? Really? Now that they're known, I think maybe within the next year is could be too quick.
Yeah.
Because it's such a big migration project. It, you know, sort of like Ethereum's just gone through the a bunch of big upgrades merge. And big the merge to proof of stake, right? So to go through that again within a year, and again, the need is not necessarily there, right? Because the threat of this is much further in the future. But we are now at the point I'm trying to make is we're at a position where you can start to look at implementing the standard post-quantum crypto algorithms.
So and we say it's nowhere near, but like everyone kind of describes Bitcoin as this bomb-proof, you know, forever resistant. Bitcoin will be there no matter what. And it's not too hard to imagine quantum getting there, let's say 50 years. And like, you do need to be thinking well ahead for 50 years if you're saying Bitcoin is the bomb-proof gold standard that everyone should invest in, the currency that will be the last digital currency to outlive them all. You've got to think of these things because, you know, if quantum does become commercial and people can break these in the next 20, 30 years, I'm not saying Bitcoin's dead, but like if they don't move this, there's going to be a lot of coins stolen quite easily.
Yeah, and as however stable you want a cryptocurrency like Bitcoin to be, the actual cryptography, the crypto behind the cryptocurrency, cannot be stable because cryptography always gets retired eventually. All the standards we've used past, right, have been deprecated eventually and been replaced. Like hash functions, you know, the ones we use in Bitcoin are not the ones that were previously recommended. True. The ones that encrypting emails 15, 20 years ago are not the ones we use now, right? So
it's so true. We might even see like a technology that basically makes the transition to quantum resistant, you know, crypto easy as well. There's things that could pop up out of nowhere. And imagine that I've actually seen a lot of projects that are trying to make that transition as seamless as possible. Yep. So I think that's basically covered it. We've gone down from six predictions last year down to four more detailed ones, hopefully. And they are huge. There's going to be more institutional adoption of Bitcoin. AI is going to be big. Digital identity and blockchain is going to be at the forefront of the conversation. And there won't be much in terms of quantum computing upgrades, or at least the threat of D-Day and the quantum kind of saga won't affect crypto in the next year. That's our big predictions. Anything else?
Yeah, I mean, four cop-out predictions in a row, probably, but no. I mean, is one thing I've learned is that you can't predict too much in this space, and you have to kind of roll with the punches.
Yeah, well, thanks for listening, and join us next time to untangle a little more of Web3. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Untangling Web3.
Don't forget to send us your thoughts, questions, and comments on social media. And be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast provider to catch the next episode. See you next time to untangle a little bit more of Web3.
The views we express here are our own and do not reflect the views of our employers.